It is now time for our feature, A Newcomer Asks, where we place this box in the back of the room along with some paper and pencils, and we have people write down questions they have about the program, about Alcoholics Anonymous, put the questions in the box, and then we select the question, and using AA-approved literature and our own panel of experts, we attempt to answer a question each week. Not funny yet. This week's question is, can you bring up resentments toward people you have forgiven? And to answer that question this week, we have our own Lee.
Hello, I'm Lee, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lee.
When I read this question, I interpreted it one way, and so I asked Bill what he thought, and of course he interpreted it a completely different way. So I'll try to answer both. Bill's interpretation of this question is, should you list your resentments in step four for people that you have forgiven? And my interpretation was, after you've made amends with people, can you have resentments again? So we'll start with Bill's. Should you list people in the resentments that you've already forgiven? And when I did my step four, I listed a lot of people that I had no resentments for anymore, but I had resentments for in the past. And what was great about it is that I learned a lot about myself by working these resentments. I learned that my misconceptions about what my resentments were about. I learned about my fears, and these all play into your next steps. And I learned how these became defects of character for me. So these all worked the next few steps that I was working into. And then I also learned that the people that I had forgiven, I actually needed to ask forgiveness from. So that played into the next step, which is making amends. And then if you look at my interpretation of this question, I think step 10 says it best when it says that we continue to work our inventories and promptly made apologies were necessary. And so, after you've worked through steps and made amends to people, there will be more resentments in your life, and you will find and you will continue to work the steps. And that's what I did, and that's what worked for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee. And now it is time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member since 2/20 of 1972. A Fresno native, he has started groups in Madera, Oakhurst, Coarse Gold, and Lemoore. Continually in service for nearly 40 years, he has held every service position in the fellowship. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Fresno, California, Fred C.
Wow. I'm Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. God, it made me sound perfect, didn't it? How's everybody doing tonight? Oh, come on, you do better than that. How's everybody doing tonight? Man, we're here, we're sober, we're clean, right? Wow, what a life. I lived a lot of my years before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it wasn't fun. After I got here, I found out I was living in a hell. I got here, and every now and then I've had to go through hell again. But I've stayed sober, and that's really what's important. You know, if you're young here tonight, and you're looking up here, and you see this old fart, and you think, man, 40 years sober. Hell, he's been sober 3 times as long as I've been alive. This is horrible. Nobody has any fun anymore, right? I'm going to tell you something right now. Being sober and clean in Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. I've had more fun here than I've ever had out there drunk or screwed up. Okay? This is wonderful here. It really is. I wasn't born in Fresno. I was born near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the country. I was the last of 8 children. Had a great childhood, great family. The only problem I had growing up, I was never beat up, molested, or anything else. My family didn't believe in alcohol at all. There was never any alcohol in the house, except one little bottle up in the pantry cupboard. When you had a fever or you were sick, they'd put a little bit of whiskey and some sugar, water, and let you drink that. It made my upper lip feel a little bit numb. I liked that feeling. They caught me sneaking into that bottle one time, and the bottle disappeared after that. So I come from a real teetotaler family. But being a younger child, everything I did in school, and I would go home and tell my parents, they would say, gee, your brother Wayne did that. Amos did that too. I sang in a choir, and my sister Roberta sang in a choir. Every time I did something in school and got home and did it, somebody else had already done it. I resented that. I really did. I don't know why, but I just resented it. I wanted to be original. The first time I got drunk, I was 13 years old. There was a guy named John Knoll who had a dad named John. And John Knoll, back in Pennsylvania, made hard cider in a barrel with raisins and sugar, and a hose went through it, and it was quite an operation. We broke into his barn one night and drank some of that hard cider. And I did some things I shouldn't have done. I wrote obscenities in people's windshields with soap. By the way, it was Halloween night, okay? I urinated in a guy's gas tank. I thought that was funny, and people saw me do it. I didn't remember that until they told me the next day. I believe my buddies, because they said I did it, so I guess I did. The next morning, the local constable showed up at our house. We lived out in the country. And he was telling my dad, and I could hear them talking outside, what I had done the night before. I could not believe it. But you know, my dad came upstairs, and he said, Fred, I got to tell you something. I'm really upset at you. Nobody in this family has ever done anything like that before. You know what I'm about to say? I felt pretty damn proud of that. I was a weird kid right off the bat, right? I played sports, had a good time. I had a scholarship to go to Penn State in Pennsylvania with track. I ran in the 440 and a half mile race in the country. I could really run. So I got a scholarship to go to Penn State, and I was supposed to do that when I graduated. But the night of my senior prom, and by the way, I didn't drink a lot during high school, just once in a while. But once in a while when I drank, I'd get in trouble. You know what I mean? I had bad luck, folks. I was not an alcoholic. I had bad luck. Anyway, the night of my senior prom, I wanted to go to Pittsburgh, which was 50 miles away with all my buddies. My dad said, no, I could only go to Butler, to a little Italian restaurant. That wasn't what I wanted to be. I wanted to be with my crowd, you know? So what do when you want to go someplace and your dad checks the speedometer to see how many miles you drive? I disconnected the speedometer before I went out on my date. I picked up this girl I had dated in high school, and we went to Pittsburgh. Had a great time, drank a little, quite a little. And on the way home, near her house, I wrecked the car. Now, my dad was an inventor and a machinist, and he loved equipment, and cars were some of that. Wrecked the car, ran into a bridge. They come and got us, and they towed the car in. And the next day, knowing that the speedometer had been disconnected, I snuck down to the garage and reconnected the speedometer so he wouldn't know how far or that the speedometer had been disconnected. I got away with it, right? Lucked out. Except the girl I had taken was kind of serious about me. And 2 days later, she caught me out with another girl. So she went and told my dad what I'd done. And that's only half of the story. Wait till you hear the rest of it. He's mad. This time he's really mad because I've lied to him. I deceived him. He treated me horribly. I said, you know, Dad, I don't have to take this kind of treatment. I'm not going to college. I'm going to join the Marine Corps. I'm going to be a Marine. He said the fatal thing that I had heard. Where do I sign? Well, I'm going to be a Marine. So he sent me down to Parris Island, South Carolina. Well, I got off of that train that day, and that little DI got a hold of me. I had long hair, and they stuck my hair in my mouth and laughed at me and made fun. They did it out of everybody. I don't know, there's nobody here probably from the 50s, but anyway, I knew I'd made one of the biggest mistakes I'd ever made. Believe me. But you know, the Marine Corps taught me how to be a man, and it really was. They also taught me how to drink. I saw some active duty in Lebanon and some other places and got out about 3.5, 4 years later. Now, that girl that turned me into my dad, when I, just before I got out of the Marine Corps, I had a week's leave, I went home and married her. You understand my choice of women? Anyway, she was an awesome woman. We had 4 children. And I got sober. Now, we had moved from city to city to city to city to state to state. I think over a 10-year period, there were 6 states and 12 cities. Most of the time, we moved after midnight. You all understand why we moved after midnight, right? We had to get out of there. Coming to Fresno, I had discovered wine. This is beautiful wine country out here. And I discovered that you could buy bottles of wine at that time, a whole gallon of wine, for $1.99. A gallon. You could get Ripple for 39 cents a bottle. It was wonderful. I was really in hog heaven. I loved this area. Still do. But I started to drink more and more. And things kept getting worse and worse, and finally I lost my family. I lost my job. I couldn't get a job. I couldn't keep a job. It just kept going downhill. I couldn't understand why I had such bad luck. Because every time I did something, I got caught. I was into agricultural plants of a nature, herbal type things. You know, if you grow the right type in the right amount, in the right area, in the middle of August at night when it's hot and humid, you can sit out there and drink out of those bottles of wine, and you can actually hear those leaves opening up, going swish, swish, swish. I was romantically involved with those plants. But it was beautiful. The moon would be out. It was gorgeous. That was my last crop that I grew. I was out drinking one night during September, the first part of September, just when the buds were coming on. You would think I'm just an alcoholic. No, I've done other stuff too. The buds were coming on. It was just beautiful. This was my money. I was rich. I have a lot of plants, by the way. I was out drinking one night because I borrowed some money because I knew I was going to be able to pay it back really soon. And I was hungover, and I got up. It was on a Sunday. It must have been near noon. And my wife is screaming, running around the house, all upset, because somebody had vandalized our backyard and ruined all the shrubbery that I had grown. She didn't know about marijuana, by the way. She thought they were shrubs. Now, if you've ever seen those plants, maybe none of you ever have done that, but you can strip those plants from the bottom up. And there I walked outside, and here's all these twigs up, and everything is gone. I'm devastated. And then I'm full of fear. What if they called the cops, too? Because when they rip somebody off, that's what they do. But that wasn't my biggest worry. I looked, and my wife had the phone in her hand, and she was calling the police to report the vandalism in the backyard. So I was able to get it stopped. I said, no, if you report this, they're going to come back and do worse things to us. So all we have to do is just forget it. Forget it. I spent the next 2 days out there digging up the plants, making sure I could get rid of all that stuff, so that if they did report me, it would all be gone. I was sick, I was hungover, I was broke, it was over, and my family was leaving again. I was all by myself. We were evicted from that house. It was a house, a little house that I had bought under the GI Bill, that I had borrowed money from my brother to make the house payment, the down payment, for $250 all I had to have. I drank that up. Then I borrowed it from my brother. And I drank that up. And then I wrote a bad check for the down payment so we could get into that house. We'd been in there 3 months and I hadn't made a payment yet. Because I was broke. I was deep. And I was all by myself again. So I got evicted from that house. The only other place to go where I'd been before was the Fresno Rescue Mission. And you know, the Fresno Rescue Mission, they have rules there you have to follow. I don't know if anybody has ever been in a facility around here. They've got rules that you have to follow, and I don't like that. I like to do what I want to do when I want to do it. And they didn't want me in there acting like that, so I had to leave. And I slept underneath the freeway across the street, you know. I had a refrigerator box. That was my home. I was proud of that place, and two guys threw me out of it, took it all away from me. So I had to go back to the rescue mission and agree to live by their rules. And I had a pair of cowboy boots. I like cowboy boots for the hell of it. I don't know why, but I do. And I went to sleep that night on a cot, and I took my boots off and set them beside the bed. And while I'm sleeping, somebody swipes my boots. So I wake up in the morning. I have no shoes, no boots to wear. I had no nothing. That was it. What was on my back? So I had to go to the shoe box. This is about 2 weeks before I get sober the first time. I go to the shoebox, and I get a pair of shoes out that will fit me. They were a pair of bowling shoes. Now, don't laugh. They had shoelaces, and they both fit, but they were two different colors. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with a pair of bowling shoes on that didn't match. And you know what? Not one person said a word about it. They didn't care. They didn't care. Well, you know, for some reason, and it could be my in-laws' doings, but my wife and kids showed back up in Fresno, and they paid a payment on the house so that we could keep the house for me. It was $112. So my wife and kids are back, so I go back home and beg to get back in. This was about 2 weeks before I go to my first meeting. It's in October, and it was cold outside. Getting really bad. 1971. Bill W. Anybody in here know who Bill W. is? Alcoholics Anonymous, right? He died in 1971 in February. This is a few months after he died. I didn't know that. See, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. But I did go to my first meeting on October the 10th, 1971. I was a Marine. The guy that picked me up was a Marine. Ex-Marines, whatever. Okay. The only thing I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous was I was in Wheeling, West Virginia for a while. I ran drugs between Wheeling and Steubenville, Ohio. And I was in a bar down there one time, and I saw a sign above the bar, and it said, "We accept AA resignations." I didn't know what the hell that meant. Okay. Another time I was at a bar and there was a sign outside on a little stand that says, AAs get their first drink free. The guy knew what he was doing, right? Because we have one, that ain't for the end, right? That was all I knew about AA. One night I cheated on my wife. I'm going to admit that to you right now. And I was in a car and we had passed out and sitting in this car, the doors were open, we both puked and it was a mess. It was a 1957 Volkswagen Bug. It was green. The right front fender was black because I'd wrecked it and bought one for $10. I wired it on with coat hangers, and the front bumper was on with coat hangers. That was my first car when I got sober, or my last car while I was still drinking. I owed money to three different finance companies on that car. I had three different titles. The front license and the back license didn't match. And I was watching for cops all the time I drove it, okay? It didn't have a gas gauge. In the old days, the Volkswagen had a lever inside. When you'd run out of gas, you'd flip the lever. It would dump a little more gas in the tank, and you'd drive a while. Well, I never knew when I was out of gas or not. It would run out of gas, and then I'd lose that car for 3-4 days at a time. So anyway, this girl says to me, "Man, I've got to get help. I'm going to AA because I'm dying." I don't know what I put together. But we cleaned up and got her out of there, and I went back home. And about a week later, I came to again on a Sunday, hungover, in a bed that somebody had peed in, me. My wife at that time was out on the couch again mad because I was drunk. I puked and went to bed. And I walked into the bathroom, staggered in there, and I walked by the mirror, and I saw the image of myself for the first time in a long time. And I was disgusted. It was pathetic what I saw. I was 28 years old. I mean, I was a mess. I'm sorry, I was 32 by then. Came here when I was 28. I was 32 and I was a mess. A mess. I was a derelict, a bum. And I felt, from what I'd heard about AA, that girl going there to die, that she was going to die, she was going to go to AA. What I heard about the AA resignations in bars, I assumed at that moment that if I went to Alcoholics Anonymous and died as an alcoholic, that that would be some honor for my family. Because I wanted to do something good for my family. I had 4 kids by then. Okay. I wanted to do something nice. So that day, after I got well enough to think, my wife wouldn't dial the phone, but she looked up the number for me, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. That was on November the 10th of 1971, on a Sunday by noon, I guess it was, 1 o'clock. And there was a guy in Fresno that was on teleservice that day, and when he answered the phone, I dialed the number and he answered the phone, and he said, "Hi, my name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. What can I do for you?" It was almost like he was proud of it. You know, it scared the hell out of me. So I whimpered and kind of cried and told him I was sick and I was dying and I had to go there. And he said, "Great, can you go until 7 o'clock tonight without taking a drink?" And I said, "Sure." I had no more, nothing to drink. I was broke, nothing to drink. He said, "Great, I will pick you up at 7 o'clock tonight." When Ed got there at 7 o'clock that night, I assumed I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous to sit in a corner someplace with a black trench coat on or whatever and drink until I died. So I packed a suitcase to go to my first AA meeting. And in those days, there weren't any recovery homes. It was all AA. So when Ed got to the door and I'm standing there with this cardboard suitcase ready to go to AA, he said, "Where the hell are you going with that suitcase?" I said, "I'm going to AA." He said, "Not with me, you're not. I'm going to have you back here in 3 hours. 2 to 3 hours, you'll be back here." And folks, that's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to go away and die. It was over. I was done. So anyway, I got in this car. It was an old Ford Pinto. It ended in sober, he said, 1.5 years. And I thought, the guy's a liar. Everybody drinks on New Year's, right? And 1.5 years is at least 1 New Year's. There's going to be a birthday in there. 4th of July. What about football games? You have to drink sometime. The guy said, "I haven't had a drink for 1.5 years. I didn't understand it. I didn't know what AA was. And he said, "My mother-in-law lives down the street from you. And my wife's an alcoholic too. We're all alcoholics." And the first thing that went through my head was, what kind of people have I got mixed up with now? So they took me to the meeting. We went to the Alano Club in Fresno. They just built the Alano Club in Fresno. It was a beautiful place. Today you look at it and you think, wow. But then, at that time, it was beautiful. Brand new building, parking lot, it was really nice. And when we got out of Ed's car, in the parking lot, there was lights on it, you know, and I walked around the back of Ed's car and up along the front of it. And when we got into the car, Ed told me that he was a Marine. And I said, "Gee, I was a Marine too." And it was on a Marine Corps birthday. And by the way, there were 3 more Marines in that meeting that night. And there was only 7 of us there. So there was 5 of us in that meeting was Marines. Anyway, that's kind of an odd thing to have happen, right? Anyway, I walked past Ed's car on the left-hand side, and I knew Ed was a pilot. I figured he must be an ace because he had been in the Marine Corps for a long time as a pilot. And on his front fender on the left-hand side, there were 5 paper Barbie dolls glued onto his fender. I thought that meant he was an ace. I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "I'm an ace. I've been married and divorced 5 times." You see, I understand the kind of guy that took me to my first meeting. We went in that meeting that night, and those people told me about what had happened to them, what they went through, and it was awesome. It really was. After the meeting, up in the front they have a sign up there that says, "In God we trust." And I figured, well, they believe in God. They can't do too much bad to me. And I listened to the steps. They read the steps, and I understood everything they said. And after the meeting, out in the Alano Club, I went up to a guy named Tommy A. He's passed away many years ago. Tommy was sober a few years when I got to that first meeting. And I said, Tommy, I understand what's in there. I understand the spiritual part about it. I grew up in a family that even had our own pew in our church. I mean, they were a great family. I understand spirituality. I understand all of that. But my problem is, I want to know how you people keep from getting drunk. How do you keep from getting drunk? That was my big concern. You see, I've taken ant abuse. Anybody here know what ant abuse is? It makes you sick. You take it and drink, you puke. I quit taking ant abuse. I'm not dumb. I even sent away a magazine one time for some pills that made alcohol taste like diarrhea, the ad said. I don't know what that tastes like, but it sure was bad. I gave those to a buddy of mine. I told him if he had a drinking problem, that would work well for him. But, you know, Tommy said something that was amazing. And that is, he said, and was the most profound thing I'd ever heard up to that point. He said, Fred, we don't drink one day at a time. I'd never tried that. I'd never heard it. I never thought that anybody would ever say anything that profound in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the idea that we can go one day without taking a drink is awesome. It really is. You know, I started going to meetings. I got a job right away. I got sober. The guy that took me to my first meeting brought me a big book 2 days after I got sober. And he brought me a big book where I worked at. And he put the cover of the big book inside out and handed it to me where I was working at so nobody would know it was a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I took it home that night and I read it. He said, Fred, only read the first 164 pages. Don't read all the stories. You have enough lies. You don't need any more stories. You just read the first 164 pages. And I was reading through that story, and they were talking about this one guy that had a problem that got sober in AA, and his name was Fred. And I thought, wow, they put my name in that book just so I would understand how much they cared about me. You know, because they had literature and books for sale. And I thought that's how they made money. And I thought that's what they wanted from me was money. Believe me, I didn't have any money. I had a pair of bowling shoes. You know? I had a coat with one sleeve nearly ripped out of it. My pants had holes in the knees. I was a mess. But they cared about me, just like everybody in here cares about every newcomer. And I want to welcome the newcomers here tonight, those ones with less than 30 days, and everybody up here that took a chip. I think it's awesome. Keep coming back. This thing really works, folks. I went to meetings. I got a job at a grocery store. I was working nights, so I didn't get to go to a lot of meetings, because then the meeting started at 8:30 at night. I'd go to the last half of the meeting. I got well really quick. I got a second job. Things were going wonderful. I got the family back. Got the house payments caught up. We owned that. We were able to live in that house. It was a little house, but we were able to do it. Things got wonderful. They really were, right away. Had money in my pocket. I didn't drink. And I went to a lot of little half meetings. I did a little bit of 13-step work. I don't know if anybody here knows what that is. Okay, so I did a lot of 13-step work, but some of it wasn't very successful. But the idea was, is that I stayed sober. 90 days into sobriety, on a Saturday morning, I'm working in a market by myself, and I'm thinking about what has happened and what's transpired in my life, and I feel wonderful. I'm sober, I've got two jobs, I've got money in my pocket, and things are going great. So on Saturday morning, I think, you know what? The reason I became an alcoholic was because of my wife. She drove me to drink. She was such a bitch. Cold, nasty woman. So I went out to the bars to look for something else and just happened to become an alcoholic. It was her fault. So intellectually, knowing that, it should be okay to drink like a normal person again. Isn't that what the big book says? So I did. I went over to the cooler and I got a can of beer. I took it back to the meat block and I opened it up, and while I was cutting the meat, packaging it, I drank that beer. It was 8 o'clock in the morning and there was nobody else in the store. We didn't open until 9. I drank that and I thought, you know what, that tasted pretty good. I'm going to go grab another one. So I went back and got another beer. That time on my way back to the meat block, I stopped in the restroom to look and see if I'd turned into that ugly alcoholic that you folks said I was going to become if I ever drank again. And guess what? I hadn't. I looked great. So back to the block, kept working, drank that one, about 8:30. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to get a six-pack because there's no sense of running back and forth wasting time. So on my way back to the cooler that time, I stopped by the bathroom again with a mirror before the store's open. I turn on the light. I look in there in the mirror. I turn the light on. I have a white shirt on with a black tie, a white meat cutter's coat. And damn, I look good. I feel good. Two big beers without any food in my stomach. I felt wonderful. So I went over and got a six-pack of beer. I don't know what happened after that. Other than at 11 o'clock at night, I come to at a bar or out of a blackout on Blackstone Avenue just south of Shields called Socko's Bar. And I'm sitting there talking to the guy next to me, and I can see this in my head right now. I'm sitting there talking to him and telling him what an awesome job Alcoholics Anonymous has had in my life. And then I realize I'm drunk. And I figure I might as well keep on drinking then. So 10 days later, I get back to the house again. I don't know what happened. I went a lot of places, did a lot of things I shouldn't have done. I remember one night in Oakland, California, in Jack's Empty Square, there's a lot of lights up there. And I came out of a blackout. I had a lot of blackouts. Came out of a blackout, and I'm walking down the street with a man on one side, a woman on the other side. And we're talking and laughing, and everything's fine. And I come out of this blackout, and I don't know who they are or where I am. I stop to get a beer on the way home from work. And I don't know what's going on. It scares me. So I cut loose and run. And they're both, the man and the woman, both saying, hey, come on back, come on back. But I took off and ran. I went to a phone booth to see where I was at. I had $87 in my pocket. I was broke when I left home because I had a beer tab at this bar. And I've always worried about that. Where did the $87 come from? Was I with the man or the woman? I had to ride a bus back to Fresno. You see, there's three things I haven't done in my life, other than in the Marine Corps, but since I've been out. I've never killed somebody, I've never robbed a bank, or fallen in love with another man. But during a blackout, I'm not sure what the hell I have done, you know? Blackouts are hard. So anyway, after 10 days, I get back home. I get up the stairs to the door, to open up the door to walk in. I get my key in the door, unlock the door. And my wife at that time had this really wonderful trick she had. When I would reach the doorknob to open up the door and get my hand on it, she would yank the door open. I would fall in on the floor on my face. She did that. I fell in on the floor again. And she said, you dirty bastard. I knew you couldn't make it. You couldn't stay sober for anybody. I walked away. I'm on the floor in that living room in that little house. A few months earlier, I'd gotten in a fight with my coffee table. I don't know if they call it DTs or whatever, but I thought a mad dog was attacking us, and I pulled all the legs off of the coffee table. So they're all duct taped back on, okay? And I'm falling across the floor, and I realized once again that alcohol had beat me down to nothing. Nothing. I was beat. And I realized there was a better way to live by now. And I said that prayer that I still said this morning, folks, when I woke up. I don't have a lot of meditation and stuff that I go through, but I said that prayer that night of, God, I don't care what happens to me as long as I don't drink or use again. I don't want to do that. Do something with me so I don't drink or use. I don't care what happens. And you know what? The next day I got up and I went to an AA meeting. I got another sponsor. I started working the steps, the 12 steps, not the 13th step. I really went through those steps. I went through them at that time. Later on in my life, at about 12, 14 years, I had to go through the steps again because of insanity that I was going through because I thought that I was so much better than everybody else. And I had to get humbled. And then at 30 years sober, I had to go through the steps again because I needed something that was more spiritual. I had 5 sponsors that I worked steps with. 5 of them. The first sponsor I had passed away. The second sponsor has passed away. The third sponsor died. The fourth sponsor died. And the fifth sponsor died a few years ago. Does anybody here want to be my sponsor? Same way in Fresno. They all laugh. You see, what we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous is an awesome program. But there's some things we must do. Suggested steps, yes. But if I don't work those steps, I'm going to fail. Okay? I'm going to fail. There's a big book close around. And I'm going to encourage you to do something. If you can't get a big book, if you don't have the money to buy a big book, if you can't get one, if no one gives you one, please steal one. It will save your life. You can make amends for it later on in the steps, okay? But get a big book because it's that important, okay? It's so important. And when I got sober, we did 12-step work. We had a 12-step call thing that we do and still in Fresno, and I'm sure you do down here. And we would go on 12-step calls. I was 30 days sober the first time that I went on a 12-step call. This was right after Christmas, just right after the first of the year. I was about 40 days sober. An LD from Fresno called me up and said, Fred, I need you to go on a 12-step call for me because we're going to go talk to a guy that's been in and out of the program a lot. He's a school teacher. He's got a wife and a couple kids, and he just can't stay sober. And I got... He had Al had several years at that time, and he said, Fred, I need somebody that's new so he can relate to you. So we went over to this guy's house over in southeast Fresno, and the house was a decent-looking house. We went in, the guy let us come in, and we're sitting there talking to him at the couch, at the coffee table, and he said, you know, I understand what you're saying, but it's just not working for me. I keep getting drunk. And he couldn't get the concept that if you don't drink, you can't get drunk. One day at a time. And we tried to express that to him. He says, you know, wait, just a minute. I got something I got to do. I'll be right back. He got up from the table and walked down the hall and went in the bathroom. Shut the door in the bathroom. And about 20 seconds later, we heard a big boom. The guy shot himself in the head with a shotgun. We ran down the hall. Al kicked the door in. There he was, sitting beside the commode in the bathtub. I'll never forget this. Slouched down in there with his brains blown up across the hill, up across the wall, and he killed himself. You know what Al did to me? He grabbed me by the shirt collars and he said, Fred, we've told you to work the steps. We've told you to do the right thing, and you're not. And if you don't, you're going to end up just like that. Scared me so bad I knew I would never drink again. I knew it. I wouldn't ever drink again. So he made me leave because he knew I was wanted for certain offenses that I had. And he made me leave because he had to call the police and get the police there. So I left. So I walked home that night here across Fresno. And I knew that night I would never drink again. 45 days later, folks, is when I went back out and got drunk. Because mentally I knew I was able to handle it. You see, we have no defense against that first drink. Other than that spiritual reprieve we get each day by working these steps. And I want to cover one more thing before I sit down. In the big book, it talks about the fact that we must grow spiritually. And I thought, oh my God, I've got to learn all these prayers and all this stuff. And I don't. The only thing I do today when I get up this morning is say, God, thank you for another day. I don't care what happens as long as I don't drink. I'm going to rely on Him. That's what works for me. Some people have to have all that stuff. But in the big book, it says we have to grow spiritually. And I thought I had to be like a monk and learn all that stuff. And that's not for me. I want to do other things. I want to have fun in life. I want to do fun things. So a guy, one of my sponsors, the last one that died, showed me spiritually in the big book where it's at and how I can grow spiritually. And if you read the bottom of page 14, okay, I'm going to tell you where it is. In the bottom of page 14, it talks about spiritual growth. And it goes on to say on the top of page 15, I get a little excited up here, on the top of page 15, what happens? At the bottom of page 14, it says is that if we want to grow spiritually, we must give away what's been given to us. And if we do not give it away and grow spiritually, and that's how we grow, it says it in the book, if we don't do that, then we will not be able to get through the highs and the lows of life. And if we don't get through those, we will drink. It says it in the book. And if we drink, it says we will die. Surely die are the words it's used. And the last sentence in that first paragraph on page 15 says, that is the way it is for us. And if you're here tonight, I assume you're an alcoholic or got other addictions. You're here for a reason. And if that's the way it is for you, what you and I still have to continue to do every day is give this program away. I am so grateful and so glad to be here in Visalia and be able to stand up here and talk. Thank all of you for listening so much. May God bless you and keep you sober. And be sure to give it away, because that will keep you sober. Thank you very much.